WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. That's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it's really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that.
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us, sir. How are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, are you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome and good evening. You are tuned in to Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. Wow, we're already in the middle of July. I swear, it just turned 2022. I can't believe we're already in the middle of the summer. And we have a great show lined up for you. Actually, our first guest is here. State Representative Joan Moschino is here.
Hello, everybody. I hope you're having a great evening.
How are you?
I'm doing great. It's been busy on Beacon Hill today.
And you're going to give us the details as to how busy it's been.
Oh, my gosh, yes. Absolutely.
And, of course, one of my favorite bills that I've been watching and hoping and praying, and many of us PEG Access folks have been watching with bated breath because it means funding for us if it goes through.
House 130.
Yes, exactly. We'll talk about that and much more, and we'll also find out how everything is in your district and how your summer is going.
Absolutely.
So we'll do that. We're also going to talk about another bill. Actually, this is more transportation-oriented, the House Bill number 4481. We have a Kalik Williams. He is a community organizer with Community Labor United. And Raina Camacho. She is with a Coalition for Social Justice. She is Brockton's grassroots coordinator. And she's going to give us, they're going to give us details about this bill. And the idea of this particular piece of legislation is to provide low-income fares to folks who are, you know, who need to use public transportation to get to and from, and knowing that everything is going up because the price of gas, the price of electricity, everything's going up, and there are still folks who need to get to work, and they may need to use the bus or the train, and this bill will hopefully keep it affordable for those particular folks. So that's coming up. That's the first hour that I have given you the entree to. Hour number two, Casey Sherman. A New York Times best-selling author. We're here to talk a little bit. We're actually on the eve, don't tell him, but the eve of the launch of his new book, Helltown, The Untold Story of a Serial Killer on Cape Cod. It's being teased right now. This right now is like one of the most anticipated true crime books of 2022. That's what some are saying. And if you haven't had a chance to read any of Casey's books, I guarantee you, if you've read his other books, you will not be disappointed with this particular book. He's going to come in, talk with us about that. And as always, he isn't like a one-trick pony. He doesn't just like work on one project. He usually has multiple projects going on, and he will lift up the curtain and he'll give us a little bit of a peek as to what's going on. So that's coming up at 7 o'clock. 7:30, we're going to talk Boston Celtics. Yes, I know it's the off season. Fear not, though. Boston Celtics are making moves. And so I got WATD sports reporter Brendan Conley will be calling in. Brendan also works for the Boston Herald and other media outlets reporting sports. We'll chat with him, as well as Nubi Ritteau. Nubi is an award-winning documentarian, a sports fan, especially a Boston Celtics sports fan. And we'll chat with them about the Celtics, the moves that they've made, the NBA as a whole. So that's all coming up in just a few moments. What we're going to do right now, I think we'll take a look at traffic. We're going to find out what's happening out on the roadways. It's being brought to you on this end, as always, by Brennan's Smoke Shop, with locations in Plymouth, Pembroke, Brockton, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, New Bedford, Weymouth, and now, drumroll please, Hudson, New Hampshire.
Hey, it's Geoff. That's what my friends call me, Geoff, 6'190". I grew up on the South Shore, and now I live on the South Coast. Trust me, I'm not the person you think I am. I'm just like you. I have two little girls that are the same as yours. My wife and I go to work while they go to school, just like you. Our friends are just like us. We all just want to live, work, and play freely. Thank you to the brave men and women who gave their lives. Thank you to the brave men and women who are currently giving their lives. Thank you to the brave civil servants that are serving our country every day. Thank you to the truck drivers and all of the workers that keep this country going. You are my heroes. You are amazing. You keep doing what you're doing, and we'll keep doing what we're doing, as long as we can, forever and ever, until death do us part. Like you, we stand with Ukraine. Like you, we stand for freedom. Our hearts and our prayers go out to all the people around the Ukraine. Godspeed. This message was brought to you by Brennan's Smoke Shop.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talk. Don't just listen, say something. Call 781-837-4900. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
So we kick things off with the State House Report. It's been it's long been a staple of this radio program, at least since I took over the steering wheel. And the idea is to have a variety of legislators, whether they are in the Senate, in the House, constitutional officers, be the governor, whenever we can lure him and suck him into the void. But today we have serving the 3rd Plymouth District.
3rd Plymouth.
State Representative Joan Moschino, who I saw at the Mass Access Spring Conference.
Yes.
Very good. And by the way, I forgot to give you photo credit because I think you took the picture of myself.
I did.
And my colleague. And he was upset at me because I posted it. I'm like going, but you're out in public, so it kind of counts.
It was a great picture, and it was really great to see you there supporting all of our community media centers. It's a really hugely important work right now.
And we get to see Matt Muratori get up.
He gave great remarks.
As always.
As always.
But so it was your turn in the rotation, and I thank you, and I thank all of your colleagues, especially the legislative delegation down here on the South Shore. It doesn't matter what party you were a part of. I think it's great that I'm able to have conversations with folks, regardless of the side of the aisle, as to some of the things that are going on up at the State House, in the district, or for the good of the Commonwealth. Mm-hmm. So we probably should start with the hottest news off of the, out of the oven, and that is that some things happening, some amendments being filed.
Oh, yes.
This very day.
So we had the huge, long-anticipated economic development bill dropped from the House today. All of my colleagues and I were very busy this afternoon filing amendments. But it's a $3.8 billion bill that's going to be part of the ARPA spend. So remember, we spent some of that in the fall. This is the last chunk of it that's unallocated. Plus, there's been surplus revenues coming into the state. And then there's also a significant bonding component of this. So, yeah, and there's tons of stuff in there. It's actually, I have to give kudos. You know me, I'm not usually like this, but I have to give kudos to leadership and to the chair of House Ways and Means. It's got Health and Human Services, taxpayer economic relief, environment, housing. I mean, there's just so many things in there, and a lot of good things for our district too, which so it's really exciting. And we're going to take that up on Wednesday, and my colleagues and I collectively filed something like 850 amendments, so it's going to be a long day, but really it was exciting to see some of the things that people were putting forward.
How many strips of bacon did you get into the griddle for this one?
All right, I did file 12 amendments. And I don't usually do that, but I did file an amendment for our streaming services bill. Okay. For those of you who don't know, we filed a bill to assess a small fee on streaming services, the same way we do for cable, and it would be dedicated revenue for our community media centers, which is responsible for all of our local programming, our trusted resources for information, especially since all the little, weekly papers are going the way of all things. So hugely important, and I think that's a good bill. So hopefully actually, we've only got, 3 weeks left. End of session is July 31st, so everything is intense. We're just trying to move as much as we can.
What's the hope that will come out of this particular, these amendments that have been filed, and ultimately, what could we see out of today's action?
So there's really a lot of, unusually, they put a lot of tax relief in there. So seniors get economic tax relief every year, and they doubled it from $750 to, I think, maybe $1,700, which will help about 100,000 seniors in the Commonwealth. Hugely important. They increased, for those of you who are renters, they increased the rent cap from $3,000 to $4,000 that you can deduct on your taxes. I think everyone saw the Globe article about the $250 stipend that would go out to a certain segment of the taxpayers. So it's really meant to be sort of part two from some of the things that we did earlier in the year. But yeah, there's a lot of good stuff, both relief, but then also investments. And it's all of the big programs that our communities do really well, getting the big grants from MassWorks, Seaport Economic Bond Council, just across the board. So it's a really, it's a well-drafted, comprehensive piece of legislation. And I've seen the summaries. I haven't even worked my way through the whole thing. It literally just came out this morning. So yeah, exciting.
You had teased one word, and I think it's an important word. Every time I've had conversations with state and local officials, housing, knowing that the housing stock is at such a crippling low levels, and we see how much it's costing these days to be able to rent or to be able to purchase a home, and just going up and up and up and up, because again, supply and demand, and there's, you know, so little supply, so there's a greater demand. Do you have any details as to what would be assisted when it comes to housing?
So there were a couple of big programs. It was about $600 million appropriated in December, and so we're continuing to work to get that allocated, but this would also be a $100 million investment in the Affordable Housing Trust Fund, which is hugely important, and then also $75 million for minority-owned housing development to really try to build out on the equity piece. So that's just a couple of things, but it was also food insecurity. There was all the economic development, the tax credits. I mean, it really is trying to sort of meet the needs of people, just regular people, and take care of regular people in the Commonwealth.
Let's digress back to bill number H-130.
Your favorite.
My favorite. Well, it's my favorite for the simple... Let's... You know, get into the Wayback Machine a year ago, or maybe a year and a half ago. And when you're talking about getting information out, who are some of the peg access stations that you know of in your district that could benefit from this?
Oh my gosh! So across the board, if your community has a peg access channel, they would get money from this. We figure there'd be about $65 million in revenue that would be split 40% for the town itself, right? Because they have real infrastructure that they have to keep up and staff. Mm-hmm. 40% for the actual programming, and then 20% for the state to oversee, because there would be parts responsible for the state would have to oversee to assess the program itself. And that's real money to these stations. It's Harbor Media and Hingham, right? Hull Cable TV. It's Cohasset is 143 TV. So, I mean, right there are in Marshfield. John Yavgoski does such a great job. Yep. And isn't it PAC TV down in Plymouth that are awesome? I mean, really.
Julie Thompson, yeah.
Oh, she's so fantastic. These are trusted resources, right? People, and I don't care what anyone says, people do really, they turn it on to listen. And it's your selectman's meeting or your school committee or... you know, the play or whatever it is. And, you know, all things, I think about my own community, all things Hull live on cable television. It's all the history. It's all the great community stuff. But it's also trusted information. So it's the place where people go to look to see during the pandemic, what were the resources, where could they go? So across, whether it's transparency and public access for government things, whether it's the trusted programming or whether it's just all the community and historic and cultural events, across the board, there's they're doing great work. So it really, if we do not pass this bill, these stations will wither and die on the vine. And then all we'll have is WATD to turn to.
And that's a bad thing. But for folks that know, like PEG, what's that? PEG is an acronym, Public Education Government. And a lot of these PEG access stations are given three channels, and they'll run public stuff, and that may be, you know, if there's a concert, let's say your community has the summer concerts, there's a good chance that that TV station is going to cover it. You're not going to see it on Channel 5 or Channel 4 or Fox, you know, Boston 25. They're not going to play that unless something bad happened or they're doing a feature. Like you said, selectmen's meetings, town meeting. These are all key components to your community and knowing what's going on, what's being passed. And then education, and they could be anything from little Johnny's sports or little, you know,
all
what
the good stuff.
All the good hyper local stuff, and I see people all the time who are like, oh, I cut the cord. Well, cutting the cord, it's saving you money. But if you're looking to get hyper local information, it's a big access stations, and a lot of them do a fantastic job. And it's not the people think of it being like the wonky, you know, the redheaded stepchild when it comes to local television. But a lot of them do a lot of great work, and it's quality work. And when it's when they're done, you know, capturing it, editing it, and running it 1,000 times, it's also on their YouTube channel or on their website that you can see for historical records.
Right.
Per se.
Absolutely. So. All good stuff.
So what happens on July 31st if this bill is not dealt with?
So for those of you who don't know, we have a two-year cycle and formal session where the House meets to take formal votes ends on July 31st, and this is the second year in 2022. After that, the House does continue and the legislature continues to do business, and we do a lot by acclamation, but if somebody objects, then that stops everything. So you will continue to see us work hard and continue to do things, but you can't bring anything forward for formal vote. So at that point, I would have to get myself reelected and get sworn back in and then file the bill again beginning next year. So that's what happens.
Do you feel somewhat dedicated to this piece of legislation and others?
Oh, absolutely. So as you all know, I'm very committed to climate. And right now, two of my climate bills are in conference. So we'll see how that goes. If that were not to happen, then I would refile the climate bills around electrification of vehicles and how we heat homes. People shouldn't be discouraged. It is meant to be a deliberative process. You don't always want us to act too quickly. You want us to vet things. Things have to be timely. They have to be ready. They have to be vetted. They have to be relevant. But I also have a permanent supportive housing bill that I'm excited to try to get across the finish line. That would create a flexible pool fund and just make it easier for places like Father Bill's to do permanent supportive housing. I've got a couple of good things. I have some care and protection bills that deal with kids in foster care. I filed them all as individual bills. I think next time we're going to pull them together as more of a comprehensive bill. It's been hard to sort of keep track of them, and they've ended up in different places, but we're still trying to get that across the finish line. So, yeah, I've got a lot still left, but it's exciting. It's an exciting time to be in the building, and there's lots of horse trading going on, lots of discussion, lots of dialogue, and everyone's working real hard.
What's it like as a legislator when something goes into a committee? I mean, do you have any sense of what the pulse is on it? Do you ever get any feedback as to, yeah, chairman's thinking about taking it up, but it's kind of under a stack of, you know, 20 other.
Oh, we filed 7,000 bills this year, so there's the hard work of getting educating committees and the chairs and their staff. Don't forget the staff;
yes.
They're very important.
Staff does an excellent job, Jordy.
And John. Yeah. So we have to really educate staff and committee members and the chairs on the bills, but you do have to show that they're timely and relevant, and that the work's been done, and that you've taken into consideration all the feedback you've gotten, you know, as you're developing and writing. So there's a lot of work. That's where it all happens, in the committee, and you definitely get feedback. Sometimes more feedback than you want, but you definitely get feedback. But that's what the good part about it is if, you know, if I hear from someone or the chair's hearing from people, you know, they want to make a change or you learn something new or the situation changes, you know, you have to be ready to continue to work with the committee and their staff and to continue to draft. So yeah, there's a real fluidity to it. There's a real art to it. So
if you're just tuning in, that bubbly personality is the state representative Joan Moschino talking about life up at the state house and when things are coming and going for legislation. You have to be thrilled that while we know that there's another variant is lurking, at least you're back up on Beacon Hill and you're meeting with your colleagues and all right, what's that been like to be able to be back with folks instead of staring at this rain for 8 hours.
Oh, so much better. You know, it's hard when you're remote just because it's about a phone call, right? And if I don't pick up, then I have to call you back. And it's just hard to catch people. Whereas when you're working on the floor and we're taking up a bill and you grab someone for just a quick conversation, sometimes that's it, or insights, or just making sure you're highlighting something to someone's attention. It's just so much it's just so much more productive. But I will also add, it's a lot more fun. By and large, all of our legislators, they're there for the right reasons. They're working on really cool and interesting things. They're smart. They care deeply about democracy. They care deeply about their districts. So it's just a lot of fun to work in the House of Representatives and to be, it's my honor and joy. And I love this job. I really am excited to go back.
Let's talk about what's going on in the district. Anything that you want to mention or touch upon?
Well, so the district is doing really well. Just to come out from under COVID's been awesome. And of course, it's a beautiful district and we have Nantasket Beach Reservation and it's just with the good weather, it's just been absolutely hopping. They have the Friends of Nantasket Beach are kicking off a program, what do they call it? Summer Sunshine Performance Series. And I think their inaugural performance of Los Gallos Locos. On July 16th, so people should definitely find their way down for, you know, where the Bernie King Pavilion is for all of the summer concerts.
Is that this Friday?
I think it is.
Yeah,
and they've got the trolley running, so you can actually get around other parts of Hull, go to dinner at Mezzomari, walk the boardwalk, stop into the artist studios. There's a lot of good stuff going on down there. It's just, and the weather's been absolutely beautiful. So,
have you tried to? I mean, what's it? Knowing how busy you are in Boston, how often do you try to make sure you make hours within your district and reach out to some of the folks who might have discussions that they want to have with you?
Oh, so I have office hours almost every single Monday. I rotate around in the district, Hingham, Cohasset, Hull, Scituate. Sometimes I'm at the senior center. Sometimes I'm at the library. July 18th, I will have office hours at Hull Senior Center at 10 a.m. And then July 25th, I'll be at the Scituate Library at 4 p.m. So you can call the office and actually make an appointment or just swing by and say hello.
Now, I'm going to ask you, here we are, July 11th. We still don't have a budget for 2023. And I think we're 11 days into the new fiscal year. Any word as to where things are with the conference committee? Are they still haggling this thing out?
Yeah, they still have a few things to work out. But what I hear is that things are going very smoothly and that there's no problems. And we did file a 1/12 budget just before we ended the fiscal year. So not to worry. Everything's still moving forward. Everything is still functioning. But no, nobody's particularly worried about that. We haven't heard. Usually you hear if there's problems. And it just really feels like this House and Senate are working really hard together and very collaboratively, which is, you know, always a joy.
How important is that? And you know, depending on what happens later on this year and opponents and candidates, you know, being part of a state legislature, I think, is vastly different than being a part of the federal government and being part of Congress. How important is it that regardless of what side of the aisle you're on, you can have your ideals, but at the end of the day, you're working for the greater good of the Commonwealth? How important is that?
It's tremendously important. Everybody comes, you're inspired to you know, to run for different things. And, you know, as a representative, I'm representing my district and their needs and their priorities. But I have to come with an open mind and be able to have a conversation, both across the aisle as well as between the chambers. So absolutely, tremendously important. And I think it really shows the relationship building and the level of collaboration and work. And, I mean, trust me, when we disagree, you usually see it in the Globe, in the debate on the floor. We will debate things. But at the end of the day, we just have to, it has to be part of the relationship building, part of the dialogue, listening to each other. And then whatever the vote is, you move forward together. That's the big thing, is you move forward together. Yeah.
Anything we haven't had a chance to touch upon, but you want to make sure that you mention while you're here?
I have a guest with me tonight. Not that he's happy that I'm mentioning it, but my husband John drove me down, and we got a little time in the car together.
I think it's awesome when John's here. Again, silent partner, which is super cool. But again, knowing that you know your significant other could be here, and you know. Be a part of the radio show, even though he doesn't say anything.
He doesn't say anything, but he sits and smiles and is tremendously supportive and uplifting. And I could tell you, you cannot be a candidate and you cannot be a state representative without the support of your family and loved ones. Because sometimes it is frustrating, and to have a trusted partner in life who not only tells me when I'm doing good and uplifts me, but also tells me when I might want to rethink things.
What is he like? What does John like to be a sounding board? Because I myself, when I'm going to do segments, I have my significant other that I can bounce things off of. I have friends who I can bounce things off of.
Oh, absolutely. Trusted resource. Super smart. Incredibly strategic. One of the few people who will really say to me, yeah, I listened to you give that speech. And, you know, maybe you might think this, or, you know, I'll say, here's what my strategy is. What do you think's important? And then every once in a while I do carry on and he will say, yeah, are we going to talk about this for much longer?
I get that sometimes too. But you need that. You need someone who is going to give you the gauge and say, all right.
Yeah.
You could turn the spigot off right now. That's enough.
Yeah.
No. Or, you know what? No, maybe you should elaborate just a bit more.
Yeah. No, it's nice sometimes even just to hear yourself say things out loud. Because not for nothing, sometimes when you say it to yourself out loud, you're like, oh, yeah, no, that was stupid. I wish I said, oh, that was brilliant more often. But
if folks want to reach out to you, mm-hmm. constituents of the 3rd Plymouth District, how can they do that?
Oh, call the office anytime, 617-722-2320. Work your way through the phone tree. I'm still junior. I sit in somebody else's suite. I sit with Mark Cusack from Braintree. He's the chair of the Revenue Committee. Or just email us, joan.moschino@mahouse.gov. And, of course, I have a website, joanmoschino.com, so you can sign up for our newsletters. And we are on social media, so you know we try to get information out about the work that we're doing. So you can just pop onto the website or pop onto Facebook or Instagram and check us out. But just call, swing by the office. Yeah, I hire wonderful staff. They're super smart, but they're also really nice. And the whole point is that when you call that office, if they answer that phone or when they get back to you, it'll be someone who's bright and friendly and listen, we're here. We're going to try to help.
Thank you so much for coming in.
Oh,
thank you for sharing your update and some of the latest that are happening up on the Hill.
Absolutely.
And we kind of teased it. I want to say it was a year ago that we had yourself.
Yes.
Representative Lenatra.
Yes.
Representative Sullivan. The 3 girls in. Almost like a law firm. We'll try to see if we can arrange the 3 of you to come back in before the summer's out.
Oh, that would be so fun. We're happy to swarm this station again and take over the show.
There you go. Absolutely. Maybe you should have your own show.
I don't know. Oh, so for those of you who couldn't hear, I got an oh Lord from the from the side seat driver.
Well, thank you, Representative. Thank you, John, for coming in as always and being great support. And thank our listeners for tuning in. We're going to step aside. That's it for the first segment. We're coming up in just a moment. More Monday Night Talk here at 95.9 WATD.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
This military moment is sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts. Iraq War vet Brandon Aronson started Paint Your Heroes, a project that honors service members who are no longer with us. Aronson's company, Paint True, delivers custom portraits to military families.
I feel like the entire nation is sort of reeling from collective trauma. That made us want to do something big. We're a very small organization, but you have to dream big.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts. This sports moment is sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts. The Big Three is back. Ice Cube, the 3-on-3 Basketball League's founder, is excited about the Big Three's newest players.
Michael Beasley and Gerald Green and Corey Brewer. So I think, you know, the competition is going to be as stiff as you've ever seen it.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get guaranteed low prices and excellent customer service from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Hi, my name is Alex Bazantin, and I'm running for Plymouth County Commissioner. I am the former chairman of the Abington Conservation Commission, former Abington Water Commissioner, and now serving in my second term as Abington Selectman. I am currently serving on the executive board of the Plymouth County Advisory Board. If you would like to learn more about my candidacy, please visit my website at alexbazantin.org or follow me on Facebook. I am Alex Bazantin for Plymouth County Commissioner, and I approve this message.
Monday Night Talk on Twitter. Start at 959WATD.com/Monday Night Talk. And don't forget to add hashtag Monday Night Talk to your tweets. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
All right, we are back. Second segment of Monday Night Talk. Hope you're enjoying your evening so far. We're going to talk a little bit about a particular piece of legislation, House Bill number 4481. Interesting enough that we had State Representative Joe Moschino here talking about bills that are just kind of languishing. Nice. We're going to talk a little bit about this one as well.
Sure.
You hear murmurs in the background. That's Raina Camacho. She is with Coalition for Social Justice. She is Brockton's grassroots coordinator.
Yeah, thank you for having me here today.
You got to put that microphone right under your nose.
Thank you for having me here today, Kevin.
The microphone likes you. It likes Kalik as well, Kalik Williams, who is a community organizer for Community Labor United.
Thank you for having me, Kevin.
You got it. How are we doing?
We're doing great today. We're excited to be here.
Well, what I'm going to give you each an opportunity to do is tell us a little bit about your respective organizations. Kalik, tell us a little bit about Community Labor United.
Great. So Community Labor United literally does what is in our name. We work with community groups, we work with labor unions to push issues that concern both parties. Instead of fighting each other on them, we're making sure that we're united and going together and fighting for, you know, what is needed for many of our community members. And today we are focused on, you know, public transit. Mm-hmm. So we're also part of the public, we also chair the Public Transit Public Good Coalition. So, yeah, that's why we are, that's why I'm here today. That's what I'm going to be talking about.
Excellent. And we have Raina Camacho, who is with the Coalition for Social Justice, and she is a grassroots coordinator for the great city of Brockton.
Yes, the Coalition is a really great space to work in. It was founded in 1994, and it brings people together who've been affected by economic issues. And, you know, we're very solid in the community and work to push issues that are going to benefit the community.
Let's talk a little bit about the bill that I just teased a moment ago, 4481. What exactly is this particular bill? My understanding is it has something to do with low-income fares.
Correct? Yeah, right. So 4481, or a bill considering a low-income fare, is essentially that. It would be it's pushing to create a low-income fare in the MBTA that would, what do you call it? Benefit low-income riders, giving them a discount on their pass in order to continue to ride public transportation, which is, you know, a big issue, making sure that folks can afford to get to where they need to go. And that's for the MBTA, and it also is a provision for the RTAs to also do a low-income fare and or do free fares, whatever works best for that RTA.
If you will, Raina, tell us about the importance of a bill like this when it comes to someone who's living on a fixed income.
Sure, Kevin. Well, a bill like this is super important in terms of legislation, and it helps to put money back into the pockets of individuals who need it, working families. You know, this bill really affects people. It'll affect us economically, socially, and in terms of health. MIT did a study not too long ago, and it showed that people who got free fare actually went to the doctors more. They actually took care of their own health first. And those are the things we want to see in our communities. You know, this bill really affects low-income individuals. It affects our elderly. It affects blue-collar workers. You know, it affects our youth. It's very important to have this staple really flourishing in our community, because it basically creates mobility. You know, we need access to mobility.
If we could talk a little bit about, I don't know how much information is known regarding the funding mechanism. Now, if this is something that is able to pass, and I know that we have a limited amount of time, hopefully action is taken before the end of this month. Is there any language in the bill as to how much money the state would fund into this piece of legislation for folks? Because you can't offer this without having some kind of financing behind it, correct?
So, honestly, there is... what we've been saying is, like, you know, there's the state is washing money right now. Like, there's plenty of money from the federal government.
American Rescue Plan Act. ARPA.
There's ARPA funds. There's funds.
CARES Act before that.
CARES Act before that. There's extra funds that came from
supplemental
tolls.
Budgets because the revenues have been projected so high.
Yep. Exactly. So there's money out there to do it. Our legislators and folks in power being able to say, like, you know, all right, we want to use these funds to go ahead and move this. And in the long run, it's something that benefits the state on a whole, right? Like, not only economically, but also in terms of our environment. Like, I hearken it back to, like, folks take a look at what happened during COVID. Mm. Like, when folks were out of their vehicles, like, what we were able to see in our skies and things that folks being like, we haven't seen the skies as clear in, like, 30 years. Like, can we afford not to move something like a low-income fare?
It's interesting you say that. I spent a couple of days in Montreal over the weekend.
Nice.
And interesting enough, took a bike tour, and the gentleman who was our guide was hardcore about it. He's like, get rid of these nasty gas, you know, these gas vehicles, and, you know, we're burning the earth, and there should be just nothing but bikes. And it's like, not necessarily wrong. I mean, you know, we are, you know, polluting it, but if there's a way for us to use public transit where there's less cars on the road,
I think that's part of the RTA bill as well, right?
Yeah,
going into more of a green phase.
And RTA is an acronym for
Regional Transit Authority.
Okay. Have there been other measures proposed in recent history to help those who need transportation assistance, Raina? Do we know has there been measures in the past that have been before the House and the Senate, or maybe the governor has had an opportunity to take a look and maybe sign in the law and decide, maybe not?
I think there has been, yeah, of course.
Yeah, in the history that I've known, we have had things like the youth pass for the MBT and other municipalities that fall into that, which is specifically a discounted pass that works for ages
17 to 24, I believe.
17 to 24, mm-hmm. Right? It's a structure. The MBTA did it. The governor didn't veto it at that time or anything like that. So it exists. And then we also have a senior pass for those 65 and up. And then there's things like the ride. So, like, there are other fare structures that allow the riding public that need it, that have a need, to access the MBTA at a discounted rate. There needs to be something for those folks that are struggling in the middle, right? These are the folks that are definitely using our transit at a higher rate than most. So,
and if you go to these stations, you'll see that there's a lot of individuals there who are, you know, doing the day-to-day, you know, going to the doctor's office. There's a lot of elderly going, meeting their appointments. There's a lot of youth who are going to classes, taking the train and taking the buses to university. You know, there's a lot of blue-collar folks heading to work. I spoke to a lady a couple weeks ago, and, you know, she was having a rough time with the change of the schedules and just in terms of income, and she, you know, was unable to take the bus anymore and having to pay out-of-pocket Ubers back and forth to work. It was costing her $60 per day, $30 there, $30 back. So, you know, it's putting families at a deficit, you know. We really need to start thinking about our communities and being more compassionate about situations.
So here's my question, and you mentioned RTAs. Would this affect something like a Brockton Area Transit? And would their fares also be reduced if this bill passed? Would that help them?
It would be, in the areas, yes.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Yeah, so each municipality is going to need to figure out what's going to work best for them.
Exactly.
So we know in Fall River, more than likely, they will not do a reduced fare pass. They do a free pass because they've run the numbers and, like, it doesn't actually make sense once we go free to actually charge anybody. It's going to be actually more money for us to do that. So each municipality has to run their numbers and look at it and be like, okay, if it's a reduced fare pass for us, this is how it's going to work, and this is who it's going to like be for in effect.
Jen, if you're just tuning in, the voice you just heard, that's Kalik Williams. He is a community organizer for Community Labor United, and next to him is Raina Camacho. She is with the Coalition for Social Justice. She is Brockton's grassroots coordinator. And we're talking about this piece of legislation, House Bill number 4481. Now, if, Kalika, this is passed into law, let's say this is signed, or this is somehow bundled, right? When could it possibly take effect? Do we know? Is there any indication?
It's a, what do you call it, interesting question for me, because I'm not exactly sure when it would take effect. I would assume by next January. It's not necessarily something that's going to happen immediate. Like, the MBTA staff needs to work with Health and Human Services to figure out, you know, who qualifies and how they can identify folks and so on and so forth. But, yeah, I think folks can start seeing, like, you know, passes roll out probably in, like, a January or so.
Now, what happens come July 31st and there's no action? I mean, do we know where it is at this particular time? What are your sources telling you as to what's happening with it?
So our current sources, what's happening with it the bill came out in the Senate, and low-income fare was not built into it, but one of our champions, Senator Lydia Edwards, has filed an amendment to put that in there. So we're seeing if the amendment is going to go through, and then we will move from there. We'll actually be having a press conference tomorrow with Senator Edwards and Rep. Adrian Madaro, who have been two brilliant champions on, you know, for low-income people being able to have access to public transit, and we'll have some rider voices, some labor voices, probably some more of my voice there tomorrow as we, you know, talk about, you know, implore the legislature to go ahead and move this forward.
Has this been getting the necessary coverage that it should? Is it getting enough exposure so it reaches the ears of those who are holding it up?
I think it is, but, you know, you just have to pat yourself on the back. Thanks to coalitions like ours, you know, we're out there on the ground with our ears to the ground and, you know, picking up our bootstraps and making sure that, you know, the community knows about this.
And
we're having real conversations in real time.
Absolutely, real conversations in real time. And, you know, it helps when folks like MassInc do a poll to check in you know, where the general public is, and 84% of the public is like, yeah, this makes sense, we should do this.
Mm-hmm.
And it helps when, like, you know, we have folks like the Coalition of Mayors, you know, come out and say a low-income fare makes sense and we should do this. They just had something in Commonwealth that came out, I think, a day or two ago. So, Yeah, they're like, there's, this is definitely a conversation that's ongoing, and a definitely conversation out there, and there's definitely folks that are calling for, you know, for this low-income fare to happen.
Absolutely, and I think COVID has really changed things for the world, you know. It's really exacerbated things, and there's, we're seeing crazy inflation everywhere. Mm-hmm. Gas prices are up to, I mean, Lord knows, they can maybe get to $10, you know. So a lot of people are really relying on transit to get to and from work and to get to appointments and stuff, and it's just really important for our communities. It's really important that those in higher spaces understand the stories and take us where we need to go.
Okay, here's the all-important question. This is the, for all the marbles in the jar, and that is, how can the listeners of this radio program help? Can they help in any way to, you know, make their voices heard, especially if they feel as though this is something that, if it's going to help those who are in need?
Absolutely. I think, you know, making sure that you're contacting your senators and your state reps, making sure that you're on the phone with them and letting them know that you care about this bill and they should as well, and, you know, letting them hear your stories. It's really, really important.
And if you need some help to do that, you know, we make sure that there are ways for you to access this information and things that we've talked about here today. Just visit publictransitpublicgood.org. It'll take you to our website where you can hit our Take Action page and join us like that, to be able to, you know, reach your legislators.
Anything in closing?
No, I think we've said it all here today. We appreciate you.
Okay, we've been speaking with Kalique Williams and Raina Camacho, and we're talking about this particular bill, 4481. Pay attention and keep your ears to the news over the next week and a half. Hopefully there is some action taken, and those who are in need will be assisted with this piece of legislation. Thank you so much. Keep me informed as to how this does and if there's any other initiatives that you're working on, and we'll go from there.
Absolutely.
Appreciate
Thank you,
it, Kevin.
You got it. Oh, my goodness. That is it for the first hour of Funny Night Talk. Where in the heck did it go? Fear not. Hour number two is straight ahead. On deck, Casey Sherman, New York Times bestselling author. I'll be here in just a moment. You're tuned in to Monday Night Talk right here on 95.9 WATD.
WATD FM Marshfield, WBMS Brockton. This is the South Shore's radio station, 95.9 FM WATD. Streaming online at 95.9WATD.com. And with your smart speaker, just by saying play WATD. This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
That truck, it pays?
What?
The bumper sticker on that truck says it pays.
Pays? Pays what?
I can't quite read it. Oh, it pays to stay way back.
Ah, what was that?
The truck! Snap back a rock! Now I've got a broken windshield.
I'm Peter Brown of Tiny and Sons Auto Glass in Pembroke. It pays to stay way back. However, if your windshield is broken, just call 1-888-64-TINIES. And thank you.
Plymouth County is a large area stretching from just south of Boston down to the Cape Cod Canal. I'm Alex Bazanson. Join me and my guests for countywide coverage, everything from the Mayflower Landing to the most recent town meetings, how national news affects us locally, and how things that happen in Plymouth County affect the rest of the South Shore. Tune in for All About Plymouth County tomorrow night at 7 here on 95.9 WATD.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
We're back later this hour. We talk some Boston Celtics. Yes, yes, yes. I know. They didn't win, but they came so close. That close. I'm not kidding. They were. I speak with Brendan Conley, WATD Sports, and Nubi Ratow. He's an award-winning documentarian Celtics fan. Might be some crying for a bit, but we'll talk sports. But more important, our recurring guest, big day tomorrow, Casey Sherman, New York Times bestselling author, And from what I understand, this book is being called, the buzz right now, it's the true crime book of 2022, Casey.
Knock on wood.
How's that feel?
It feels good, man.
For someone to say that.
Yeah. It didn't come out of my mouth. It came out of somebody else's, and I couldn't be more excited.
Somewhere else.
Yeah, exactly.
How does it feel?
It feels good. This is a project that was I started during the height of the pandemic. So, you know, very solitary writing assignment for myself. Worked on it for, almost 2 years. And now I can kind of bring it out to the public and get their take on it.
So, just so we can see, we don't want to tell them what the whole book is about, because the purpose is for them to go buy it and read it themselves.
Absolutely.
But let's give them a little bit of an appetizer.
Sure.
And then they can belly up to the bar and order from the menu.
Okay. Well, Kevin, imagine if Jack the Ripper had been resurrected to stalk the women of Cape Cod. That wasn't fantasy. That actually happened. And it happened in the year 1969. It's one of the most brutal serial murder cases in American history. And it was forgotten by history until I took a really close look at these murders 50 years later and said, oh my God, you know what happened in 1969 on Cape Cod is one of the most horrific crimes in American history, and it should be written about.
How do you pick a project like this? I mean, what kind of research goes into what you're going to say, this has all of the elements that I like and that I see that I feel that I can do good and do justice for this particular case?
Those are all the questions that go through my mind. You know, is this a book? Is this a screenplay? Is this a magazine article, or is this nothing? You know, at the height of the pandemic, I just wanted to get out of the house. So my brother Todd and I, we took a drive up to P-Town, and we're driving down Commercial Street. Beautiful day, but it was completely deserted. So we started to talk about ghosts real and imagined in Provincetown and on Cape Cod, and we ultimately landed on this murder case back in 1969, where you had a young amateur taxidermist who had mother issues. Does that sound familiar?
Well, sure does.
Yeah, sounds a little bit like Norman Bates in Psycho. Well, there was a real Norman Bates living on Cape Cod, and this person was a psychotic, and he was very charming, and he was a hippie-like messiah who was luring these young women into dark areas in Truro, murdering them in the most gruesome ways possible, burying them in shallow graves, and dismembering their bodies.
Now, was it a complete cold case? Did you have anything to kind of go on to kind of start to tell your story?
Yeah, so it was a bit of a challenge because all of the documentation hadn't been kept up to speed with the DA's office. I didn't really know where to begin or where to end, but you pull a piece of thread and you see where it goes. So ultimately, I was overwhelmed by documentation. 2,000 documents, from crime scene reports to investigative documents to trial transcripts to autopsy photos and crime scene photos that I'm still traumatized by today. I've covered, up to 50 homicides in my career. It's where I started.
Right.
I've never seen anything this horrific. And, my first book, as you know, was a book about the Boston Strangler case. Sure. Because my aunt was the last victim. And I was very leery to go down a dark journey with another serial killer, which is why I kept this story at bay for decades. I grew up on Cape Cod. I'd heard the story almost in a joking fashion. The killer had a nickname. They called him Tony Chop Chop because he dismembered his victims. And he was looked at as kind of the boogeyman to little kids running around Cape Cod, which I was one at one time. But then, when I took a fresh look at these murders, and I said, oh my God, this is so horrific. And it's so unique because the killer had what, we now call ego splitting, which was a split personality that he was blaming these murders on. And then I wanted to elevate the genre, Kevin. I just didn't want to write a procedural about a murder case on Cape Cod because I wouldn't be interested in really reading that. And I found out that there were two literary legends, Norman Mailer and Kurt Vonnegut, both living on Cape Cod at the time, and both become darkly obsessed with covering this case.
Wow. That's pretty cool. Now, are they still with us, or are they no longer with us?
The two writers? Yeah, they've passed on. So I didn't have a chance to interview them personally, but I did talk to a lot of people around them. And I got, I had to do a deep dive on Vonnegut and Norman Mailer. And here you have two you know, basically they were handed the baton from Hemingway in the late or mid 20th century, and they became the literary icons for the next several decades. And these two writers were at different stages in their careers in 1969. Norman Mailer was a household name. He'd been a best-selling author since his first novel was published, The Naked and the Dead, in the late 1940s. Kurt Vonnegut, this is pre-Slaughterhouse-Five. So Kurt Vonnegut is a struggling writer. He's working and managing a Saab dealership on Route 6A in Barnstable, and he's struggling. And he's got this story in his head about his days as a POW in Dresden during World War II. That ultimately becomes Slaughterhouse-Five, which is a signature novel in American history. But he's not there yet. So, you know, to pass the time, he stumbles upon this murder case that is evolving on Cape Cod with this, you know, young serial killer and the pursuit of this killer before he could commit more murders.
So the book is already number one on Amazon?
Yeah, it didn't take long. You know, the book doesn't come out till tomorrow, but, you know, it's flying off the shelves. And I think, you know, I think that speaks to, you know, true crime as a genre that's really kind of exploded over the past couple of years. And again, I credit or blame the pandemic, because everybody was at home. Everybody loves to play armchair sleuths, and they get sucked into those documentaries or docuseries on television or reading books like Helltown. So I think, you know, this is a perfect time to get this book out.
So I have to ask you this. You know, you usually different books. You, how did you choose this one? You're like, this is the one that I'm going to sit down and I'm going to take on, instead of having maybe you and Dave Wedge have written many a book, or who's the gentleman you did Finest Hours?
Yeah, Mike Togas.
Mike Togas. How do you decide that, you know what, I'm taking this on myself, I feel this is something that's in my wheelhouse, or well, maybe I'll have somebody join me? What's that process like?
It depends. You know, Dave and I have a great partnership, and we always look at projects that we can work on together. You know, Dave was embarking on a solo project, mm-hmm. which was fantastic, and that was his first, and I was really proud of him for doing that. And I had this story kind of kicking around in my head, and I knew I could tell it because I had the perspective of growing up on Cape Cod and knowing, you know, the characters and the streets. And, you know, looking at, I mean, the, you know, I wrote a pretty macro book about 1969, because that year right there reminds me a lot of what we're kind of dealing with in 2022, where, you know, basically, hope is gone. So in 1969, the summer of love is a distant memory. They're just off the heels of the Martin Luther King assassination. RFK is dead. You've got a never-ending war in Vietnam, bloody protests at the DNC National Convention. And then you eclipse the 1969. It's the Nixon inauguration, Chappaquiddick, the moon landing, and ultimately the Manson murders. And the characters in Helltown have direct connections with all of these historical events.
That's definitely interesting. And what was it like to kind of figure out that the dots are connected somehow here?
Well, that was you enjoy that process as a writer. You know, I mean, do you want to put a microscope on these murders and leave it at that, or do you want to expand upon it, try to elevate the genre of true crime by incorporating some of these historical elements? And that was the challenge that I was faced with, but I learned a lot during the process. I was born in 1969, you know, the day that the killer moves into a boarding house in Provincetown, where he ultimately lures his last two victims, was the very day that I was born, just down the street at Cape Cod Hospital. So, you know, it felt like, okay, this is the setting in which I came into the world, and it's time to explore that.
Just tuning in, we're speaking with Casey Sherman, best-selling author, New York Times best-selling author. He's going to talk about the new book, Helltown, get out of my mouth, The Untold Story of a Serial Killer on Cape Cod. So were there any issues as far as writing this book? Was it seamless in writing, or did you have certain times you get to points of researching or writing, you're like, something's not working here?
Well, I mean, you go through that process, and it's a daily grind. But you know, I mean, now, you know, this is my 15th book, Kevin, so I feel like I can sit down at the piano and just play. And I love where that, you know, where the stories take me. I have a loose idea on where I want to begin the book and a very loose idea on how I want to end it. You know, getting there is the journey, but, you know, during that journey, I'm receiving documentation. I'm listening to audio taped interviews with the killer. I'm interviewing many of the investigators, and I'm also viewing crime scene and autopsy photos. And those stay with you. You know, thank God that I had, you know, my wife as a companion during this process, because, you know, it did bring me down some dark roads that I didn't want to revisit my own family's history, given the Boston Strangler case. So, you know, I would have to take a pause. And then, you know, eventually that pause would lead me back to my writing office and I'd start all over again.
Been on the tour. You've had multiple interviews. What has it been like to be able to talk to the different media outlets to get the word out about this book that you've put together and researched and written?
Sure. It's much different than the two books I had released during the pandemic, Hunting Whitey with Dave Wedge and The Last Days of John Lennon, right, with Dave and James Patterson. You remember, Kevin, you and I were talking via Zoom on a computer. It feels really good to be in front of people again, to, you know, get there, you know, very interesting questions, and just to have a conversation. Because as much as you try, you know, in Zoom, you know, it's you're worried about technology and, you know, my internet going down, and I wasn't really, you know, I couldn't focus on the questions that I was being asked and answering them thoughtfully because of the world we were in at the time.
Yeah, talk about engaging the folks who come, who read your book. I know that you have a book signing in Hingham later this week.
Yep.
What's that like, sitting down and having someone up who is a fan of your books come up to you and talk to you?
Well, it's exciting, and it breaks down that fourth wall. You know, people think that, you know, writers or authors are unapproachable. Mm. And I'm just the opposite, as you know. I love to engage anybody, and I learn more about them than they probably learn about me in the process. But I will say that, you know, something unique is happening on this book tour that hasn't happened in the past. I had an event scheduled in Provincetown where these murders kind of, you know, began, and that event has been canceled. That event was supposed to take place in August, and the killer's friends and some of his family members have taken to the internet, and they've gone online, they've gone onto Facebook with some other social media outlets, and they have harassed the bookseller, and the bookseller had to cancel the event. And I was really concerned with the bookseller's safety and the safety of his store. And it's interesting that, you know, a lot of these people were around in 1969 as these murders were unfolding, and some of these folks were protecting the killer. They were harassing and intimidating witnesses. They were harassing police investigators. So 53 years later, it's still happening. But, you know, I don't back down from anybody. You know, I've been in this skin for a long time in terms of being an investigative journalist. You know, as I said, I feel bad for the bookseller, but for anybody to say that you can't sell a book, or somebody, you know, can't do a book signing, you know, the family of the killer, they have a right to stay home and not engage. And I respect that. But don't tell a bookseller what they can do or what they cannot do. Imagine, and again, look at the books I've written, Kevin. Imagine the Tsarnaev family coming out and say, well, we don't want you to do a book signing on the, you know, Boston Strong or Patriots Day because we're offended. Or the Bulgers saying, can you please not do a book signing here in Boston because, you know, we live close by? No, hell with that. You know, they have to live with it, but other people have to learn about this dark history as well.
Is another exciting event happening tomorrow, 2 p.m., a virtual town hall,
yeah,
on Facebook with a Boston TV station.
Yeah.
How great is that?
It's great. You know, and that's one of those opportunities where you get, you know, people from all over the world who can log on to Facebook Live. It's NBC 10 Boston.
Yep.
And they can ask as many questions as they want. And I'm very transparent, very honest with my answers. So I'm looking for a lot of engagement there. It's exciting that, you know, the journalistic community in Boston, and I would say nationally, has embraced this book. You know, they've embraced me over my career because we're all, at the end of the day, ink-stained wretches, and we've all gone through the wars of either broadcast journalism or print journalism, etc. So, you know, we support each other, which is what I enjoy.
Let's quickly go into the realm and give a a little bit of a thumbs up to your big bro.
Yeah, so I appreciate that. So my brother, Todd Forrest Sherman, he goes by the name of Todd Forrest. He's got his debut novel coming out this summer.
Excellent.
And it's a novel about love, loss, and death on Cape Cod. Todd's been writing and researching this book for several years now. And, you know, I've been trying to, you know, give him as much support as I can, because he's given me so much support. And I said, Todd, you know, this book is ready to go. You know, you got to put it into the hands of readers and get their take on it. And I think it's going to be well received. He's put his heart and soul in it, and I'm really proud of him.
That's awesome. It's nice to see another Sherman who's
exactly.
in the thing. I also want to make sure I throw out there, I'm a big fan of not only the hardcover or the paperback, but I also love audiobooks.
Uh-huh.
And this, your new book is also an audiobook.
It's an audiobook, and I did the recording for the audiobook.
Yes.
So I thought it was easy work until I sat in that studio for 27 hours and read the book. And I'm surprised I still have my voice after that.
This something. So a couple of weeks ago, I interviewed the great Natalie Jacobson.
Oh, of course, yeah.
And I read her book, but I also listened to her book.
Yeah.
And I honestly think there's something different when it's coming from the author's lips.
Agreed.
And so great.
And one thing, you know, I mean, all the audiobooks that have been done, you know, via my books, you know, sometimes you get they're all trained actors, mm-hmm. but they, you know, they'll screw up a pronunciation, and that'll drive me berserk. So I wanted to make sure, because, you know, there are so many regional, you know, references in Helltown that I did not want anybody to mess up. And I knew, you know, the difference between these words, and I was going to say them correctly. And it became my responsibility to tell that story.
It's fantastic. You're a gentleman who is not somebody who just puts all his eggs in one basket. You usually have a couple of things that are going. Maybe some are progressed a little bit further than the others. What else do you have?
Sure. Well, I'll say that, you know, before I even wrote Helltown, I'd written a 70-page treatment of what the book would be. And my managers in Hollywood said, we can sell this in 24 hours. And sure enough, they come back to me and they say, Robert Downey Jr. wants to option the rights to the book. His company, Team Downey, that's run by his wife, Susan, and a team of incredible movie and television executives. So I've been working with them over the past year, handing them every page as I'm writing it so that they could wrap their heads around what a limited series is going to look like. So we're about to actually walk into HBO in the next few weeks, because they have a first look deal there. We've got our lead actor who's going to play Kurt Vonnegut in the limited series, who's huge, but I can't say his name now. We have a great director, a great showrunner / screenwriter. So, you know, oftentimes you package these projects up, so it's a undeniable sell to the network. So that's happening on one side. As you remember, we took our podcast, Saints, Sinners, and Serial Killers, to the stage at the Wilbur Theater this spring. It was an amazing experience because it was something different, not just performing our podcast live in front of an audience. That's been done 1,000 times. We actually employed 20 professional stage and screen actors to encompass these roles of Whitey Bulger, of the Boston Strangler, of John Lennon on stage, and it was a four-dimensional.
Yoko.
Yeah, and Yoko, who was amazing, by the way. The actress that played Yoko was fantastic, and I think it just brought these stories to life in a way that I'd never seen before on stage.
I was there, front row for it. It was fantastic in the way you did it. There was, you know, little nuggets of each.
Uh-huh.
I think even at one particular point for one of your books, in regards to your aunt's passing, where you actually are talking to the individual.
Yeah.
And that was so surreal.
Right. It's, again, breaking that fourth wall. And, you know, one of the differences between the work Dave and I do and others is that we live these cases. You know, we just don't write them from afar. A lot of times we're, invested in these cases. One of the acts in Saints and Sinners on Stage was an act called Bad Blood, which was about a murder case that I wrote about in Franconia, New Hampshire, where, you know, one of the killers
was really good.
Yeah, it was the actors were all intense.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm showing the audience what a kind of a bull in a china shop like reporter like me, you know, going into a case like this thinking he's just going to gather all the material and write about it. But, you know, there are dangerous people out there that want to do reporters like me harm. And I was showing the audience, you know, some of the different tricky situations that we get into.
Yeah, love the elements. Mike Joshua did a great job.
Fantastic.
As kind of your narrator, per se, and keeping the flow going. And even had a guitarist up there.
Yeah, like Chris Spagone. And,
I didn't know there was another Spagone.
Yeah.
No, Dave.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, that's a relationship that Dave Wedge had. Yep. So, you know, we always bring friends and family in. And Mike Joshua is also our producer on the podcast, and he does great work here. So, you know, it was a great opportunity to give local talent, you know, an opportunity to play this historic stage in Boston. So we're fine-tuning the show, and, you know, we're looking at dates, you know, later this year, probably, you know, heading into 2023. You know, we might bring, you know, Dave's new book, Riding with Evil, to the stage. We'll certainly bring Helltown to the stage. So we want to mix it up a little bit and, you know, provide some new information to our audience members.
I was going
to
say that. Is your books are basically the arsenal for these different acts, which is fantastic.
Yeah.
You can. It's almost like being a musician where you can, you know what, okay, if you're Aerosmith and maybe Dream On is going to be in this set list, maybe it's Helltown for this one,
right?
Stuff like that. So would you stay regional? Would you just stay with the Wilbur? Or are you talking about on a road show?
Yeah. I mean, I want to bring this show to Broadway at some point, you know, and that's, I always think big, because it doesn't help anybody to think small, you know, and I just think we have a unique show to you know, share with people, especially, you know, in New York or in L.A. And, you know, as I said, true crime is at the height of its, fame or popularity right now. So we want to take advantage of that, but we also want to be sensitive, you know, to the victims in these cases, as we were you know, on stage, as I am in the book Helltown. You know, the women that were lured into these dark woods by the serial killer, you know, they were flesh and bone at one point. They had hopes, they had dreams. Their only crimes were acts of kindness and compassion toward a stranger that they wanted to help out, and ultimately that cost their lives. So I never want to lose sight of that, you know, going back to my aunt Mary Sullivan and understanding what she went through and what my family went through and has and continues to go through, you know, almost 60 years later. So we always want to, you know, pay our respects to that side of it.
I have to ask you, is because there was some of the media, some of the stuff, how did you remain composed seeing a lot of that stuff and seeing a lot of the historical stuff?
Sure.
You know, how did you keep yourself composed without, because there's a little emotion there.
Yeah, there is. And, you know, I mean, you have to just kind of bite down on your lip a little bit and, you know, understand that, you know, the audience is feeling something, the same thing you're feeling, you know? So I never want to lose, you know, myself, but I also want to show emotion because I'm an emotional guy, you know, and I'm human. And, you know, sometimes I do get choked up when I talk about these things, and it's, no, these aren't crocodile tears. You know, these are, you know, I've lived with it for, you know, my whole life. And I certainly, you know, feel, you know, compassion for a lot of other people that have gone through the same thing.
Any more of the podcasts themselves, the standalones? Is it going to be another season of just those standalones?
No, we're going to do another season probably in September. You know, once I get through my book tour, Dave's still on his book tour. So, you know, we're kind of ships passing right now. But then we get back. It's like, you know, Mick and Keith or, you know, John and Paul. You know, we will get back to the studio and we'll, you know, start making magic again. We're already looking at a book that we're going to team up on. And, you know, once that's ready for an announcement, we'll come here and announce it to you, Kevin, because we think it's a powerful book. And I just signed another book deal to write an L.A. noirish true crime story that happened in the 1950s. And you may recall Lana Turner. Lana Turner was, you know, basically Jennifer Lawrence from the 1950s. She was dating a gangster who worked for the boss of L.A. named Mickey Cohen, and he turns up dead on her carpet in her Beverly Hills mansion. Lana Turner's 14-year-old daughter is accused of the crime or confesses to shooting this guy. Story's a lot different than how it was ever portrayed in the media and how, you know, it was portrayed by history. So I'm going back to L.A. because L.A. Confidential is one of my favorite movies. So I want to really dig into that period in history and not only write about the crime or what really happened in that mansion that night, but certainly bring all those historical elements to bear.
Again, we're speaking with the great Casey Sherman, talking about his new book, Helltown, The Untold Story of a Serial Killer on Cape Cod. Folks want to find out more if they want to follow. Maybe there's a book tour. Maybe you're going to be at a bookstore, Barnes & Noble, wherever.
Yep.
How can they find out more information?
Yeah, they can just follow me on Twitter, Casey Sherman 123. They can follow me on Instagram, Casey Sherman Writes. And just hit me up on Facebook. And I'll be appearing at Barnes & Noble in Hingham on Saturday at 2 o'clock. So folks on the South Shore, get there early because the books are already flying off the shelves. I was in there yesterday. Now, well, the bookstores are putting the books on sale days before the official publication date. I love that. You know, I have no problem with that. But they're like, Ace, you know, these things are moving fast, and we can't keep up with the orders. So I would say anybody that wants a signed copy from me, show up at 2 o'clock, and I'll be happy to sign them for you.
And I mean, how many editions, does it matter how many editions you go through? I mean, will your publisher be able
to... Sure. Yeah, they can move very quickly. It was a first printing of, I think, around 80,000 books. So we'll see how quickly it takes for that first edition to be depleted to go into the second printing.
Casey, as always, thank you for being willing to come on in, get behind the microphone, and talk about some of your great projects, your books, your radio, your podcast. It's an honor and a privilege.
It's always a great. I mean, this is. I look forward to this appearance more so than anything else during these book tours, Kevin, because you and I have a great conversation together. So I appreciate it.
Get out, get that book. And again, he'll be at the Barnes & Noble this Saturday. Again, Casey Sherman, our guest. We are going to step aside the final segment of Monday Night Talk. Yes, it's sad, but it's going to be a good one, too. Just a moment. You've tuned into Monday Night Talk here at 95.9 WATD.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Each year, about one out of two men and one out of three women will develop cancer. But there's good news. Today's cancer survival odds are much better than 2 or even 3 years ago. Things move that fast. So if you're diagnosed, be sure to have someone in your corner who is on top of all the latest cancer treatments and techniques, the latest research, the newest equipment, all the newest medicines available through clinical trials. And speaking of corners, here's more good news. Advanced Cancer Care is now just around the corner. The Green Cancer Center at Signature Healthcare treats patients locally, with all oncology services and specialties conveniently housed under one roof. The center is affiliated with Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, so you'll be seen by Harvard Medical Faculty physicians and oncologists. The Green Cancer Center at Signature Healthcare, in affiliation with Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Cancer has just met its match. Find out why at mysignaturecare.org/cancercare.
Did you book the Townsend's 10th anniversary ticket?
Alona's travel agency is overbooked and experiencing delays. She needs to land a new project manager to clear her business's runways.
Yes, Mrs. O'Hara, we checked. Pygmy goats do not count as emotional support animals.
Indeed can help her hire great people fast.
I need Indeed.
Indeed you do. You can schedule and conduct virtual interviews all from your employer dashboard. Earn up to $500 in sponsored job credits by interviewing on Indeed. Visit Indeed.com/credit. Terms and conditions apply.
Rock Legends, sponsored by O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Legendary singer-songwriter Jim Croce died in a plane crash when his son AJ was just 2 years old. Today, at 50, AJ remembers his dad by performing Jim's music for new audiences and keeping his legacy alive.
I have this memory of the warmth of embrace, and while it's not visual for me, it's palpable.
Think O'Reilly Auto Parts for all your car care needs. Get the parts and service you need fast from the professional parts people at O'Reilly Auto Parts.
Go ahead, indulge yourself. Every Wednesday night, tune in to Talk with Francesca and join me for provocative conversation, intriguing stories, and inspiration. So sit back and relax, or be stimulated, or both, because being connected feels good, and who doesn't need more of that these days? Don't miss Talk with Francesca Wednesday nights at 9 on 95.9 WATD.
Yeah. Monday Night Talk continues all week long. Go to 95.9WATD.com/Monday Night Talk and keep in touch on Facebook and Twitter. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
All right, we are back. What a great show. A great conversation with Casey and Raina Camacho and Kalik Williams and State Rep Joe Moschino. And it keeps getting better. We got an award-winning documentarian in the house. We had a New York Times bestseller in here just a moment ago. And we transitioned to an award-winning, an Emmy award-winning documentarian and a beloved Celtics fan. Newbie Rattel.
I got a, while I was walking in here, I got a little paper cut.
Why'd you get a paper cut?
I got a little paper cut on the way in here, and then I saw green. Rich. I'm like, I bleed green. I didn't think I physically was able to bleed green. I bleed green.
It's a lot of cheese on that toast, I tell you.
Wow. I'm like, oh my God, this is incredible.
So newbies are part of the conversation. We're expecting Brendan Conley to call in. He'll join us, WATD sports reporter, and talk about the Celtics. Talk about the Boston Celtics. And with no Brendan here, the floor is yours. I want to get your take on WTH, the Boston Celtics.
You know, I think ultimately we look back at this year was a success. And we, you know, we take a look back, obviously it was disappointing we lost to 6 games to the Golden State Warriors, because we should have won this series looking in when you look at what the situation, mm-hmm. we're up 2-1. Yep. Okay, in Boston, our chance to go up 3-1, yep. up by 5 with 4 minutes left, had an opportunity to go up 3-1, we win the series. Yep. We win the series. But when you look back, and you know, I'm a Celtic fan, we look at objectively, we were too young, too mature, particularly Jason Tatum. He frankly was not ready for the moment, and you could see that Steph Curry was ready for the moment. And that was the difference.
Veteran.
That was the difference. You know, it reminded me of the Orlando Magic when they made the finals against the Houston Rockets. And on paper, Shaquille O'Neal, Nick Anderson, and Penny Hardaway should have swept the Houston Rockets. I mean, they had a better team, better defense, quicker and faster. But you had a veteran team, Hakeem Olajuwon, Kenny Smith, you know, and the whole nine, Robert Ory, etc. And a veteran coach, Rudy Tomjanovich. I mean, it was really kind of, I compared it to the Orlando Magic, and we just weren't experienced enough.
If Penny Hardaway had won at least one championship, would he still be in the, would he be coaching in the NBA today?
I think so.
Yeah?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay. I think Penny Hardaway should be coaching the NBA regardless right now. Okay. You know, but the Celtics weren't experienced enough. And Jason Tatum, he had a meltdown. And you can call it what it is. Yeah. He's an excellent player, first team all NBA, you know, all defensive team. I think he made the third team, but he had a meltdown. He wasn't ready for the moment, and that's okay. He's only 24 years old. At the moment, I was upset, but he wasn't ready for the moment. I'm hearing things about Jalen Brown wants to leave, and all.
Don't jump ahead. Don't jump ahead.
But
I'm not jumping.
I'm just saying.
Stay over there, Blee Green.
We're good the way we are.
Okay. All right. So we got Brendan Conley, who is finally joining us. He had a jump out today's National Slurpee Day. He had to jump on and get a Slurpee.
Oh, it's a big deal.
It's a big deal. So Brendan, welcome back to the show, sir.
Hey, Kevin. It's good to be back from 7-Eleven. I got my 64-ounce half-gallon jug ready to fill, ready for hot takes. Let's go.
All right, so here's my question for you. Did the Celtics beat themselves, or did they just simply run out of gas against Golden State?
I think it was a combination of two things. I thought they obviously felt the moment. I think that was pretty evident. The moment Jason Tatum had his press conference ahead of the series, I knew that he was kind of in shock of the situation. He was looking at the banner, looking at the logo, saying like, wow, we've made it. This is it. And it showed. It showed over the course of a few games, and he didn't play his best. He had probably one solid Jason Tatum game where he put up a 28 spot. He had a couple of rebounds here and there, but the rest of it, he was kind of a no-show for the most part. I am curious to see how the offseason shakes out. It seems like the Celtics have added a lot of great pieces in the meantime. We still have to wait and see what happens with the Kevin Durant saga. But overall, I just think they were a little bit – they were definitely gassed from going up through those gauntlet series early on in the Eastern Conference playoffs. And then I just think they felt the moment. They just weren't ready for that scenario. And they were playing a team that, frankly, is very accustomed to being in the finals. So I don't blame them for falling short, but – would have liked to see them come away with a championship, of course, first since 2008.
What do you think, Noob? Did you agree with what Brendan said in regards to the Celtics?
Yeah, the Celtics wet their pants. I agree.
they wet their pants.
They are who we thought they were. Yeah,
they are.
You know, I thought they had an opportunity to win the championship. Denny Green. Yeah, they had an opportunity to win the championship, but again, Draymond Green and Steph Curry. You know what? Let's simplify it. Steph Curry had a better series than Jason Tatum. That's what it came down to. Steph Curry had a better series versus, if Jason Tatum had a better series than Steph Curry, we win. Doesn't matter what the other players do. Draymond Green and these other side players, Klay Thompson.
Four words. Ice water in, five. Ice water in his veins.
Absolutely.
Ice water.
And I think, here, again, I'm not making excuses. I think Rob Williams was not 100%. Nope. And I'm not sure if he's ever going to be 100%, to be quite frank with you, because we've been saying Rob Williams, when is the last time he's been healthy? Okay? So I'm excited for this offseason because I think we just got to tweak and not change. If we change, I'm going to lose it. I'm hearing a lot of change, and I'm not a happy camper about that.
So let's digress right to the offseason. Now, prior to the offseason, Brendan, would you say prior to any moves, would you have already penciled in the Celtics to repeat as favorites in the Eastern Conference?
No, I wouldn't have penciled them in. I would have put them in a tier of teams, probably with Milwaukee, Philadelphia, depending on how things shake out in Brooklyn. I was maybe the Nets. I was going to put them in a handful of in that tier with a handful of other outlets. But as things have gone on, I'm starting to put them further ahead. I think they've improved. Now, have they got improved leaps and bounds as to what they were last year? No, they've added some pretty good pieces, however. I think that it will definitely help them in situations like we saw against Golden State, where they just went into these lulls. They didn't have that guy or that spark off the bench to come in and really get them out of it. I think with the additions of Gallinari and Brogdon, you won't see that as frequently next season.
So you like the addition of Brogdon and Gallinari?
I know Brogdon's got an injury history. The contract's a little bit much, but they essentially didn't trade anything of value to get him. So you're just bringing in a sixth man, essentially, off the bench who will come in and potentially replace the production that you need for Marcus Smart when he comes out, possibly even at a better rate. And Gallinari, I think, is a great spot-up shooter. He helps them in so many different ways. And I felt like this was destined to happen. I just felt like Gallinari's always been tied to the Celtics for some reason. Finally came to fruition.
So if we were to give Brad Stevens a grade as a general manager, what would you give him, Newby? What would you give him as a general manager so far since taking over?
A-. I think he's an excellent general manager. I give him an A-. I think he brought in the right coach. I think, you know, bringing in White was an excellent addition. Mm. You know, he kind of, you know, didn't perform the way he wanted to in the finals, but I thought in the Eastern Conference Finals, I thought White was a big reason why we won. And then, you know, really, the offseason was, I'm really impressed with it so far. I think ultimately, you know, when you look at the Celtics situation, you know, everyone talks about, you know, we need a point guard, we need a point guard. I would love to see a point guard like Mike Conley here, honestly.
Ball handler.
I think Mike Conley would have been great. You know, and I'm sure, you know, what the Utah Jazz is planning on doing with him. I would love to see Mike Conley in here. But Marcus Smart gets unfairly criticized because he's, they talk about Marcus Smart shooting when, you know, the offense was stagnant. But the issue is nobody else was shooting. Jason Tatum wasn't going to the ball. Jaylen Brown weren't going to the ball. If you look at Marcus Smart's shots, they weren't bad shots. And why the heck is Jason Tatum not calling for the basketball? Mm. Physically coming to Marcus Smart and saying, give me the ball. You know, so Marcus Smart takes a lot of criticism. We're talking about we need a point guard. Yes, we do need a point guard. But we do need our superstars to be more assertive. And Marcus Smart was taking those shots because our superstars, frankly, weren't assertive. So I think he gets unfairly criticized in terms of we need a point guard. Yes, we need a point guard as a backup, but I think, you know, the criticism of, you know, getting Malcolm Brogdon, that's going to solve all the problems. It will help to, you know, to lessen the load of Marcus Smart, but he's not a pure point guard as well.
If you just tuned in, you are tuned in to Monday Night Talk here at 95.9 WATD. We're talking Celtics, talking NBA with Newby Rateau and WATD sports reporter Brendan Conley. So news has come out that Kevin Durant, he wants to be traded. Brendan, here's your chance to dish a hot take. Where's he going?
Well, I don't know. As each day passes, I think it's starting to become more and more likely that he ends up staying put. I'm seeing Brooklyn adding instead of subtracting to their roster. I thought this was a team set to go into a full rebuild, kind of what they did a few years ago when they tried to, you know, basically take a shot with Kevin Garnett, Paul Pierce. It didn't work, and they started to reset. Thought they were going down that road again. Apparently, I don't know. I don't know if it's going to happen that way. I think it's becoming more and more likely that he ends up staying put. Now, does that mean that Kyrie Irving's going to stay put in Brooklyn, too? I don't know. But I figured that we would have had some traction by now. Could it still happen? Could somebody emerge and offer a great package to Brooklyn for KD services? That remains to be seen. I think it's a possibility. But each day that passes, I think it's more likely that we see him staying in town.
Hey, look, everybody thought Baker Mayfield was going to get traded right around the draft, right? That maybe somebody would come in and go, we'll take Baker because, you know, Deshaun Watson's going to Cleveland, right? But, you know, how long did it take before they decided, before Cleveland said, you know what, we're going to send you to Carolina. We'll take a fifth-round pick. We don't value this kid that much, right? I think it's the same way.
I mean, it could happen. Something like that could happen. But I think Sean Marks is probably just trying to get a horse's ransom, basically.
Yeah.
He does not want to just give this guy away for pennies. He's trying to get the best deal in return. And I don't blame him. They have leverage on Kevin Durant in this situation because of his contract and the no-trade clause in it. So I think they can pull this as long as they want. And I think if this was a different situation where Kevin Durant had more control, yeah, maybe we would see it happen quicker. But I think the Nets are just trying to get the best return possible, and I don't blame them one bit.
Yeah, everybody wants to be, you know, the Danny Ainge of horse trading when it comes to pulling off the big trades and, you know, trading away your old aging veterans and getting this big lucrative package of draft picks that are going to be, you know, unprotected top 10 picks.
Let me just ask this question to you guys. Why do the Brooklyn Nets need to trade Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving? They're under contract.
They don't need to do a darn thing.
No. They're under contract. This sense of entitlement in the NBA, because I want to get traded, I want $1 million, doesn't mean you have to give it to me, Kevin. You know that, right?
Yeah, I don't have it, so you're not going to get it.
I can request a check for $1 million. That doesn't mean I'm going to get it. Just because you request a trade, that doesn't necessarily mean you're going to get it. This is baffling to me. Why do they feel the need to trade him? You stand pat. You still have Ben Simmons. Whether you think he has some issues or not, he's still one of the top point guards in the league. Mm. Okay, if he gets it together, and hopefully, you know, he gets his personal life together. You got KD, obviously, top two best player in the world. Him and LeBron, you know, top two, top three.
Yep.
And you have Kyrie Irving, you know, one of the most, you know, box office players in the league. I don't care. Talent wins. No matter how dysfunctional you think those players are, you put them three on the court, they're going to put some numbers. And Ben Simmons, everyone's forgetting about Ben Simmons. You got Ben Simmons, Kyrie Irving, Kevin Durant. I'm not sure if they can pull it together. That's still a top three team in the Eastern Conference. And to leave that is baffling. Like, where do you, like, I don't understand Kevin Durant's word. What is his goal? What's the goal now? To go somewhere else and win a championship? Because you have somewhere else in Brooklyn. Like, I don't get the end goal for Durant right now.
So when the Durant news broke, you had fans in Boston who were tweeting and saying that the Celtics should trade, make a trade for Kevin. And many fans were saying, yeah, trade Jaylen Brown. Is this something the Celtics should pursue? Brendan?
Well, I was going to say it depends. You got to figure out what Jaylen Brown's level of commitment is to the Celtics. I think he's shown that he's been a committed player. He's shown that he's been a voice and a vocal leader in that locker room, and he can be a part of a championship-winning core, a championship core on a winning team. But the problem is, if he's not going to stay long term, and you have the opportunity to bring in a guy like Kevin Durant and immediately assert yourself as the team to beat in the NBA. I don't know. I would say it's a possibility, but it would be a tough move for a lot of fans to stomach, because I feel like Jaylen Brown has become a superstar in this league, or for at least an all-star for the most part, and Celtics fans have fallen in love with him. So I think it's going to be tough. It would be a very painful trade, but I don't know. You got to find out his level first.
Celtics are up 2-1 versus Golden State with 4 minutes left, with an opportunity to go up 3-1. I've never seen, let's just use an example here, and I'm just bear with me.
Bear with you.
Okay, bear with me here.
Bear with you.
Let's just say Klay Thompson, Golden State, okay? And you just won a championship. You trade away Klay Thompson? Like, you're that close. You trade away your second best player?
Right.
I don't get it. We're so close to win the championship. We're the favorite to win. I don't think we got to blow up the team. We trade Jaylen Brown. We're in essence blowing up half of the team for a player coming off 2 years coming off an Achilles injury, who's 34 years old, going to be turning 34 yeah, years old.
I agree.
And is a fight risk. Who's to say he's going to like Boston? Who's to say he's going to like Boston?
He doesn't.
Okay, I mean, so.
He doesn't. He has a chance.
So maybe he plays 1-2 years and wants to get traded again. Mm. Why not go younger?
Well, so here's the thing. Now, do you want to answer that, Brendan, before I ask the next question?
Well, I was just saying, a few weeks ago, like, I was of the mindset 100% all in on basically that take right there. I was saying, like, the Celtics can't trade Jaylen Brown for this flight risk after all the drama that has happened. Just with all the rumors and the stuff that you're reading on the tea leaves, your brain starts to shift a little bit. You start to change your line of thinking, and I don't know, I'm starting to kind of fall one way or the other at this point, whereas a few weeks ago, I was a staunch one camp, do not trade Jaylen Brown.
Does Kevin Durant seem like a Boston type of guy?
No. Oft injured.
Yeah, but we're too intense over here. He's not going to like the media.
Yeah.
Social media problems.
Yeah. You know, I mean, like Kevin Garnett was a Boston guy.
All right, but here's the problem. Here we go. Now, here's the rumors. The latest rumors say that Brown is feeling disrespected because fans want to trade him for a player like Durant. So here's my question. Is it possible that Brown isn't in a Boston uniform either at the start of the season or when Yeezy is negotiating his new contract in 2 years?
Well, he has 2 more years left on his contract before he's a free agent.
That's correct. But wouldn't you want to try to lock him up now? Or try to lock him up in the next year? I would.
I mean, I think
give him a max.
I don't think he's a max player. I don't think Jaylen Brown's a max player.
Really?
Jason Tatum's a max player.
But don't you think he thinks he is?
He probably does, but he's not a max player.
So you don't think that Jaylen Brown would utter the same words John Wall did when he made it to the when he got traded to Clippers? He goes, I don't need to be Batman every night.
I mean, Jaylen Brown only made one All-Star team. I mean, the delusions of grandeur by Jaylen Brown, he's an excellent player, but he's only made one All-Star team. You know, I think he's made NBA All-Third Team once in his career. I mean, who do you think you are? I mean, Gus is not true, but I mean, you're a good player, but you're not a max player. I think Jaylen Brown's a solid number two. Now, will he get there? I think he will be. Yes, I think he eventually will get there. But, you know, I don't think right now he can honestly say, I want a max contract. I mean, perform in the finals. Step up in the finals. And make more than one All-Star team.
Don't turn the ball over.
Don't turn the ball over. Learn how to dribble.
Turn the ball over.
So Jaylen Brown's
you have one job.
Jaylen Brown's actually so. If Jaylen Brown's listening right now. Boston. Jaylen Brown. Boston loves you. I love Jaylen Brown.
You got to tweet that though. You're gonna have your followers tweet.
Just because one person tweets that, you know, they trade. First of all, if someone said I want to trade Jaylen Brown for the second best player in the NBA, I mean, I'd feel a sense of like, wow, this is amazing. This is what people think of me. But listen, ultimately, Jaylen Brown is a great number two. Will he be number one? I don't know. But I think ultimately, 2 years, let that contract play out. And then that last year, then you could possibly think about trading him. Yeah. But you have 2 years left on a contract. I mean, you're halfway down.
Listen, if they talk about trading you for Taco Fall, then you should get butthurt.
Yes.
Right?
But if you're trading me for LeBron James, hey, listen. You know what? That's a pretty good trade.
No, I'm all set.
You know?
Speaking of...
If you want to trade Newbie for Spike Lee, I'd take that trade. You know what? That's a good trade.
I'd take that trade. I would take it. Although I think Spike's past his prime. You? You're coming into your prime.
Yeah.
You come in India. Spike's already had his prime. He's coming gone.
Kevin Durant's past his prime.
School days.
Yeah, so. Kevin Durant's past his prime. Yeah. We still take him, though.
Yeah. What about some of the moves that have been happening around the league? What are you guys watching? Brendan, anything you're watching?
The craziest move I saw was Danny Ainge fleecing another team and giving them a bunch of draft picks. Albeit this time, I think the Timberwolves are getting a slightly younger and more all-star ready player in Rudy Gobert than the Nets were getting in KG and Paul Pierce back in the day.
Yeah.
Unbelievable what this guy's able to do. Like, he goes to another organization, just assumes the same role, and other teams are still falling for the same crap. He was able to get another incredible deal done.
Nah, it's not the same team.
It looks like.
It's the Timberwolves. He's already fleeced them once.
Oh, that's true. This is true.
That is true.
He did.
It's just
the
one
second
team.
Time.
It is the same team. What am I talking about? Yeah. But it's unbelievable what this guy's doing. I am curious to see how the Karl Anthony Towns Rudy Gobert experiment works, because if it pans out and works, then you've got some of the strongest big men in the league right there. You have two towers underneath. But if it doesn't, it could be an ugly situation just in terms of chemistry.
What about you, Newbie? Anything you're watching around the NBA?
I'm watching Miami. Miami is the new, I think, L.A. Mm. You know, players want to play in Miami. Good destination.
Jimmy Butler's... I'd want to play with him.
Just for the
sake to live there.
Yeah, exactly. Just right, for the sake of the contract. Yeah, I mean, Texas and Florida, but, you know, if you want to live in Miami or Dallas, you're going to choose Miami. You know, I think eventually they're going to get Donovan Mitchell.
Really?
I really think so. I think, you know, Jimmy Butler, needs another wingman.
What about Kyrie?
No. I think Jimmy Butler would kill Kyrie Irving. They just literally.
Say, you think Butler and Kyrie in the same locker room?
Oh, man. I mean, they're just two polar opposite people.
So staying with Kyrie, the rumors that I've seen is the possibility of Kyrie heading to the West Coast to play with the Lakers. And Russell Westbrook, who is obviously not talking to LeBron because they had a game, right? Did they have the summer league game, and yep, they were at opposite ends of the court? That's trouble right there.
I feel bad for me. I think this is his sixth team in 6 years, something like that.
Who, Russell?
Yeah. But why, again, why does Brooklyn need to trade? Any logical person with their brain in their head says, I'm going to trade Kyrie Irving for Russell Westbrook and think that's an even trade.
Now, hold on now.
What are you smoking?
Hold on. Go easy now. Hold on. Russell Westbrook, didn't he already play once with KD?
Who do you want? Kevin Durant or Russell Westbrook?
No. What I'm saying is, would you want Kyrie or would you want Russell?
Kyrie.
Okay.
I think Kyrie in the heartbeat.
The problem is this Kyrie is temperamental.
I don't care. Okay. I'd take him in a heartbreak over Westbrook. I love Westbrook. He has a great heart, everything. He can't play. I mean, that's the fact of the matter. I don't understand why, again, just because LeBron wants to trade and Kyrie wants to trade doesn't necessarily mean you have to make the trade.
I think LeBron's done.
No, I don't think he's done.
He's done.
I think Lakers will be back.
You could add all
the... He's coming back, but I don't think they're going to be relevant in terms of winning titles.
Yeah, you could add all the second-gen stars, Scottie Pippen Jr., whomever else, Shaq's kid. I don't care who you add. I don't see the Lakers.
Kevin, let's take it easy here, guys. The Lakers won the championship 2 years ago. We're talking like this was 10 years ago.
It was in the dome.
I'm not saying they're going to win the championship.
There's an asterisk on that.
A healthy Anthony Davis is still one of the best top two big men in the world. Oof. And you got LeBron James.
But he's off injured.
I said a healthy one. I don't know. That's a big one. But I'm just saying, you know, to act like the Lakers don't have two of the best players in the world on one team. I mean, they'll be competitive next year if they can stay healthy. I'm not saying they're going to light the world on fire, but they'll be a top They're going to be the top 4 or 5 seed.
All right, so here's one of the final conversations here. One of the final questions, right? Who's going to come out on top? Who's going to be your Western Conference champ? Who do you see the cream rising to the top in the Western Conference? Doobie?
I like Memphis. I think they're going to make a few more moves.
You like Ja, huh?
Yeah, I'm a big Ja Morant fan. I like Memphis. I'm telling right now, I'm going Memphis and Minnesota. Anthony Edwards is a stone cold baller. Okay, I like the way his game is. He got the Twin Towers right there with Gobert and Karl Anthony Towns. That's gonna be a special team. I'm gonna say this: Memphis or Minnesota are coming out the West. I guarantee one of those two teams.
Brendan, can you top that?
Well, I like his Memphis pick. I think that's a team to watch going forward over the next few years. John Morant's just going to get better and better. But I would lean, it depends on the Ayton situation. If that doesn't work out and he's gone, I don't see Phoenix being back in the finals at some point. But I would lean Golden State for right now. They are the NBA champs. They have most of their key guys coming back. I think they lost one or two of their ancillary pieces, which could play a key role next season. But I still think they're one of the favorites to watch. But Memphis is a good pick. I like that one, potentially.
Yeah, and you even had Wiseman didn't even play this year, and they still won.
Really? Exactly. So they're basically welcoming back another piece that they didn't have. So I think Golden State is the favorite to come out of the West right now, but that could all change with another move or two.
East, and who would you pick in the East, Brendan?
I honestly think it's not to be simple here. I think the Celtics are the favorites to come back out again because they only improved upon last year's roster. Which is hard to believe. They've actually added two better pieces. So they're probably the favorites right now. I am curious to see how the Bucks do with Middleton coming back. How healthy does he look? And will the Bucks be right back to being the Eastern Conference finalists that they usually are? I think that's a big possibility.
Eat the last word, newbie.
I agree. I think Milwaukee and Boston, I would give the edge to Milwaukee.
I would too.
I give the edge to Milwaukee, just the way they played Boston and pushed them to 7 without Middleton. I just think Giannis, I love Giannis as a player. I mean, he'll just die on the court. He's the anti-Kyrie Irving. I mean, he just plays hard, good person, you know, steps up. I like Giannis. I'm picking Milwaukee, but coin flip Milwaukee-Boston.
Guy bleeds green, and he picks the Bucks. Hey, listen, newbie, thank you for coming in. Brenda, thank you for joining us. I want to thank all of our guests this evening. You have been tuned into Monday Night Talk here at 95.9 WATD. Stay tuned. New talk show on tech. You are tuned into 95.9 WATD until next week at 6:15 p.m. Have a great night.
FM Marshfield, WBMS Brockton. The South Shore's first choice for live team coverage of breaking news, emergency traffic, and severe weather. WATD.